It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Search resumes for missing Malaysian jet. Russian minister tells U.S. there are no plans to enter eastern Ukraine. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Australia has sent search planes to the remote southern Indian Ocean as efforts resume today to locate possible debris from missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. An Australian satellite spotted two large pieces of what investigators say could be part of the plane. One piece is about 24 meters long. Another one is 5 meters long. The pictures were taken earlier this week and released Thursday. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who first announced the findings on Thursday, warned against making presumptions about the nature of the objects, saying it will be extremely difficult to locate them.
I would like to inform the House that new and credible information has come to light in relation to the search for Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 in the southern Indian Ocean. The Australian Maritime Safety Authority has received information based on satellite imagery of objects possibly related to the search. Following specialist analysis of this satellite imagery, two possible objects related to the search have been identified.
The debris is thought to be about 2,500 meters southwest of the Australian city of Perth. Darkness, clouds, and rain prevented rescue planes from seeing anything on Thursday. A Norwegian cargo ship happened to be near the area when news of the debris was announced, but failed to spot anything during a night-long search. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he has received official assurances that Russian troops massed near Ukraine have no plans to cross the border. A Pentagon spokesman said Hagel spoke Wednesday for nearly an hour with the Russian defense minister. During the call, Hagel asked why Russian troops are deploying along Ukraine's eastern and southern borders. The spokesman said Hagel was assured that the troops are conducting maneuvers and have no plans to enter Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Russia could face stiffer U.S. penalties for its annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. In a Thursday interview with VOA, Kerry said the U.S. will not allow the unilateral actions of one country to destroy what he called post-World War II order and international structure.
We're prepared to respond very, very strongly with additional serious sector sanctions if they continue to engage in illegal and provocative activities like crossing the border of an international of a country. And they're not respecting the sovereign territory.
Kerry commented on the same day that U.S. President Barack Obama announced new sanctions against Russia. The United Nations top human rights official says sectarian violence in the Central African Republic remains at a terrifying level and has prompted atrocities that include cannibalism. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay spoke at a news conference Thursday in Bangui. Pillay said the CAR has become a country where people are not just killed, but are tortured, mutilated, burned, and dismembered.
I particularly am appalled about decapitation, mutilation of body parts, eating of the flesh of human beings. The incident of the mayor of Mbeki is another extremely shocking incident where he was killed, decapitated, and the woman held up the genital parts that had been cut off him.
Read more about this story at voanews.com. South Korean officials say its National Security Council has agreed to a proposal by Washington that President Park Geun-hye hold three-way talks with U.S. President Barack Obama and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the sidelines of an international nuclear conference in The Hague next week. Presidential spokesman Seoul told reporters today that the foreign ministry will make a formal announcement on the meeting later in the day. President Park has repeatedly refused offers to hold a bilateral summit with Mr. Abe, citing Japan's refusal to apologize again for crimes committed during its colonization of South Korea from 1910 to 1945 and Japan's use of Korean women as sex slaves and during World War II. For more on these stories and all of today's news, be sure to visit our website at voanews.com. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Friday, March 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Who is funding Nigeria's Boko Haram?
It is a very well-funded organization where it has so many sources of income, including in Nigeria and in that whole region. It does get money from the piracy, especially from the west coast of Africa.
Jan St. Pierre is CEO of the Counterterrorism Modern Security Consulting Group. The murder of an opposition figure leads to tension between Rwanda and South Africa. Will South Sudan's delayed peace talks finally get underway today, Friday? The U.S. State Department unveils a new initiative to respond quickly to gender-based violence. And Uganda said it's ready to provide assistance to its citizens in Ukraine.
Right now, we are monitoring the situation, and the situation currently warrants that there's no need to repatriate Ugandan citizens from Ukraine because it's a mixture of Ugandans.
Fred Opollot is Uganda's foreign affairs spokesman, and Syria tops the list of asylum seekers in industrialized countries. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In one of the poorest regions of the world, Nigeria and Boko Haram insurgents fight with advanced weaponry and disappear into the shadows after massive attacks. Security analysts say funding for these operations is most likely vast and varied, and the only way to permanently stop the fighting is to cut it off. Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja.
Late last year, militants bombed a police station, an army base, and attacked the Nigerian Air Force. They left behind the bodies of two suspected Boko Haram fighters, tangled in bicycles that the residents say they were riding during the attack. But their low-tech vehicles were deceiving, analysts say, as the Boko Haram militancy continues to evolve. Now the group appears to be awash with high-end weaponry. Jan St. Pierre is the CEO of the Counterterrorism Modern Security Consulting Group.
They're starting to get their hands on heavy-grade equipment like artillery, things like that. So you don't attack the Air Force bases and the military bases without having more support either. So it's a combination of two factors.
Boko Haram is an Islamist militia that preaches a harsh form of Sharia law. It has been blamed for thousands of deaths in the past 4.5 years in attacks on schools, churches, mosques, and the government. Its more recent targets include villages and a heavily fortified northern prison. But how, in this impoverished region, do local militants make enough money for heavy weaponry? St. Pierre says foreign militant groups like Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb may be partially funding Boko Haram, but their income likely comes from a much wider variety of sources.
It is a very well-funded organization where it has so many sources of income, including in Nigeria and in that whole region. It does get money from the piracy, especially from the west coast of Africa, drug trafficking.
Boko Haram's expenses, he adds, are considerably smaller than for a regular army. Mostly, St. Pierre says, the militants need money for weapons, which are increasingly available and cheap, as unrest in other parts of Africa and the Middle East have created what he calls an arms trafficking highway. Bank robberies and stealing from the Nigerian military are other ways Boko Haram has paid its bills, says Elizabeth Donnelly of the Africa program with London Policy Institute, Chatham House. But she cautions that it's difficult to pinpoint details of the funding, just as it is hard to know what the group stands for, or how big it is, or who its leaders are.
I think on the one hand, as time has gone on, infiltration of the group has become more difficult. I think the other thing is that actually Boko Haram seems to take steps to clear up evidence after attacks, which is also a problem.
Politicians and traditional leaders in Nigeria often accuse their opponents of supporting Boko Haram financially. But Donnelly says there is no hard evidence from any side that this is true.
Our reporter Heather Murdoch in Abuja. Relations between South Africa and Rwanda have sharply declined since the murder of a Rwandan opposition figure living in Johannesburg. In the 3 months since then, there has been an armed raid, diplomatic expulsions, and increasingly bitter accusations. Peter Cox has more from Johannesburg.
It has not been a good few months for diplomatic relations between South Africa and Rwanda. Two high-profile Rwandans who'd sought asylum in South Africa were attacked. A former Rwandan intelligence chief, Peter Kariega, was found strangled to death in his Johannesburg hotel room on New Year's Day. Then, in early March, armed men broke into the safe house of former Rwandan military chief Faustin Niyomwasa. The South African government said it was an attempt on his life. Kariega and Niyomwasa had a lot in common. Both had a falling out with Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Both sought refuge in South Africa. And both were among former top army officers who started an exiled opposition party. South Africa accused four Rwandan diplomats of playing a part in the attack on Niyomwasa's home and expelled them. In return, Rwanda, which has denied any link to either case, kicked out six South African diplomats. Kofi Kwaku is an Africa analyst at the University of Witwatersrand School of Governance in Johannesburg. He says the recent developments show that South Africa cannot protect asylum seekers.
In fact, South Africa is quite kind and very meek to a large degree. South Africa is very weak in its response to what's been happening on its own territorial integrity, where you have people violating it, assassinating other people. So there's a grave issue of security, but also, most important, insecurity in South Africa. And that is sending a wrong signal.
Rwandan officials have long maintained that some of the anti-Kagame dissidents living abroad, including those in South Africa, have planned or carried out grenade attacks against Rwandans. Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo posted a series of tweets in March accusing South Africa of protecting terrorists while expelling law-abiding diplomats. With tensions so public, what is the next step for South Africa and Rwanda? Weston Chilaho is a research fellow of African diplomacy and foreign policy at the University of Johannesburg. He says while tensions have escalated, it seems that both countries have left room for negotiation, with neither government expelling the heads of their respective diplomatic missions.
I don't think they will fall out entirely. My take is that they'll find a way of meeting each other and resolve this matter and try and bring the diplomatic relations back to where they were before now.
In the meantime, South Africa's Department of International Relations has issued a stern warning that action will be taken against any individual or group that abuses the human rights laws of the country. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
After several days of recess, the third round of peace talks between South Sudan government and forces loyal to former vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar are set to begin today in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The talks were supposed to have begun yesterday. Lucy Pony of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
The delegates to the talks had been given 2 weeks by the IGAD mediators to consult and prepare for direct talks on national issues. It appears little or no progress was made at the last round of talks, which ended on 6th March 2014. Anti-government delegate Goijo Yuliol, speaking from Addis, says he welcomes this latest round of talks but still has a major concern.
But there are a lot of issues on the table, including the seven. The government doesn't want them to participate in the talks. They release detainees. Tomorrow we're going to find out the exact position. But otherwise, we don't have any major problems.
Last week, IGAD agreed to deploy a protection and deterrent force to protect the monitoring and verification mechanisms as well as key government installations, a move welcomed by the government. However, the anti-government delegates are opposed to the move. Again, Goijo Yuliol.
You know, we are very optimistic about the whole process being handled by IGAD through a dialogue. We were just worried a little bit about the troops that had to be brought in and all this, because we were not informed in the first place, and there's a lot of things we need to discuss about.
Goi says his side will make a decision after hearing from IGAD on the troop deployment and the participation of the seven former detainees. Meanwhile, the government and anti-government forces have repeatedly traded accusations over violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in late January. There have been calls for more inclusive talks in this round, such as bringing in civil society organizations. Whether or not that will happen remains to be seen. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is the 21st day of March, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The Ugandan government says it is prepared to provide assistance to its citizens affected by the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, according to Foreign Affairs spokesman Fred Apollo. He says Uganda's embassy in Moscow is monitoring the tense and political and military situation in Ukraine after Russia officially made Crimea a part of the Russian Federation. Apollo tells reporter Peter Clarty that the situation has not reached a point that would compel Kampala to bring home its citizens.
Right now, we are monitoring the situation. The situation currently warrants that there's no need to repatriate Ugandan citizens from Ukraine because there's a mixture of Ugandans in as far as our residents is concerned. There are those who are a majority who live, have jobs, are married in the Ukraine, and also there are students. In total, we have about 86 Ugandans in the Ukraine. We have about 54 adults and 32 children in Ukraine. Of the 54 adults, about 17 are students. So for those that will want to come back are mainly the students, and that is a specific group that we are very closely monitoring for their need if they really need to come back.
Have the Ugandan citizens there expressed any apprehension about the current situation in Crimea? Have they expressed any concern that they need the aid of the administration in Kampala?
No, certainly. The situation is tense. Our embassy that looks after the Ukraine is in Moscow, and our ambassador there has a comprehensive list of a majority of Uganda. Like, we cannot claim that we know of the whereabouts of every single Ugandan in Ukraine. No, but what we are saying is that we have the groupings who are in constant touch with the Moscow, our embassy in Moscow, and the embassy is on a daily basis.
Following the recent development that your government is monitoring, will the relationship between Moscow and Kampala be hampered following this recent crisis in Ukraine?
The bilateral relationship between Kampala and Moscow has not changed at all. The position has not changed at all. Reason being, Uganda has a clear position. Uganda's stance or position is that it cannot get involved in internal matters of a legitimate state.
So there's no political interference in the internal affairs of countries you share bilateral relations?
No, absolutely no political interference, and we stand by that.
Have you heard any concerns expressed by Ugandan citizens living in Ukraine of any help to possibly leave the country following the recent crisis?
No, we have our ambassador in Moscow is closely engaging with the Ugandans in Ukraine. And as far as their concerns are, there's no need of repatriation back to Uganda.
Fred Apollo is Uganda's Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesman. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clarty from the capital, Kampala. The U.S. State Department has unveiled a new initiative to respond quickly to gender-based violence. It will address the urgent needs of survivors of severe gender-based violence, as well as individuals under credible threat of imminent attack. Mariama Diallo reports.
The program aims to provide immediate help to people facing violence because of their gender. U.S. Deputy Secretary William Burns introduced the program on Thursday.
Working through local partners, we'll be able to provide funding for medical expenses, emergency shelter, psychosocial support, and legal assistance to survivors.
A consortium of eight groups, including the Avon Foundation, will run the program. Elise Nelson runs Vital Voices, the international organization that is leading the effort.
It's something that I think we need to not just have NGO leaders around the world, dealing with and trying to combat, but we also need corporations to recognize that it's in their interest to stop violence against women, and obviously governments as well.
Cindy Dyer, Vital Voices vice president, says violence against women occurs in every country, and the only way to stop it is to hold perpetrators accountable. She says the new program will help do that.
The initial seed money is over $1 million, and the Avon's support, the support of the Avon Foundation for Women, is allowing us to provide the second component of this initiative, which is to provide multidisciplinary training for criminal justice professionals and the direct service providers that are on the ground in countries.
South Africa, India, Nepal, and Mexico are the first countries to take part in the program. Nishi Kant runs Shakti Vahini, an organization in India fighting violence against women. He hopes more victims will seek help.
It is really very difficult in a country like India for a woman to come out and speak about such kind of issues that this has happened with her. We as a service provider are trying to reach out to as much community women groups as possible.
Singer Fergie, the Avon Foundation for Women Global Ambassador, says she is shocked by the statistics. One in three women in the world suffers from gender-based violence.
There are laws to protect women and punish their abusers in many countries, but they aren't applied effectively and consistently, leaving women unprotected.
This new initiative, she says, will help countries better enforce their laws and stop the violence. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
A new report finds that Syria is turning out the largest number of people seeking asylum in industrialized countries. The UN Refugee Agency's just released report on asylum trends in 2013 shows a sharp rise in asylum claims in 44 industrialized countries last year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The report says nearly 613,000 people lodged claims for asylum in North America, Europe, East Asia, and the Pacific last year. This is the highest total for any year since 2001. The UNHCR says this sharp rise in asylum seekers is being driven primarily by the crisis in Syria. That country now tops the list as the world's main origin for asylum seekers, bumping Afghanistan into second position, with Russia in third place. The director of UNHCR's Division of International Protection, Volker Türk, calls Syria an international game changer.
Last year I was in Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and it is clear that the longer people are in displacement in often very difficult situations in the neighboring countries, the more you will see that desperation drives them to get on with their lives, to reunite with family members in other countries, and to find ways and means to get out of a very difficult situation.
The report finds that six of the top 10 countries of origin are experiencing violence or conflict. They are Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Somalia, Iraq, and Pakistan. It notes the 38 countries in Europe attracted the biggest increase in asylum claims, nearly 485,000. Germany received the largest number, followed by France and Sweden. The report says North America received the second highest number of asylum claims, amounting to nearly 99,000. It says the United States is second only to Germany in the number of applications received. Turk says the numbers of asylum seekers in this year's report clearly reflects what is happening in the world today.
You will see that the numbers in relation to Central African Republic, national seeking asylum, is not yet reflected in these numbers, neither is South Sudanese.
The report says the acceptance rate of asylum seekers, those who are recognized as refugees or are given temporary international protection, varies widely. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Nigeria recovered from conceding a third-minute goal to edge Colombia 2-1 in their Group D tie at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in Alajuela, Costa Rica on Wednesday night. Nigerian midfielder Ihuoma Onyebuchi was crowned player of the match. Nigeria joined Ghana, Japan, Italy, Mexico and Venezuela in qualifying for the quarterfinals with the game in hand. Tomorrow, Saturday in Tibas, Zambia face Costa Rica as Ghana tackle Canada, while Nigeria encounter Mexico in San Jose on Sunday. Staying with women's football, Ivory Coast welcomed defending champions Equatorial Guinea in Abidjan in the qualifiers for the Africa Women's Championships this weekend. Ethiopia play Ghana, Zimbabwe host Zambia, Senegal face Cameroon, Comoro Islands play South Africa, Rwanda engage Nigeria as Algeria face Tunisia. Meanwhile, the Union of North Africa Football Association Boys Under-17 tournament starts in Rabat, Morocco today, Friday. It includes Algeria, Egypt, Libya and Morocco. Turning to rugby, South Africa and Kenya face off in the opening encounter at the IRB Rugby 7 series in Tokyo, Japan tomorrow Saturday. They will each play Argentina and Japan in other Group B fixtures. At the start of the sixth leg of the nine-part series, South Africa are second with 97 points, two behind reigning champions New Zealand, while Kenya is eighth with 47 points and Zimbabwe 17th with 1 point. Turning to athletics, the 19th edition of the FISU World University Cross Country Championship takes place in Entebbe, Uganda tomorrow Saturday. A record 12 of the 23 teams at this biannual event will be from Africa. Japan are defending champions in both the men's and women's contests, while Algeria were the best placed Africans at the last championships in Lodz, Poland in 2012. They were third in the men's contest and seventh in the women's event. This is the second time the event is being staged in Africa, after 2006 in the Algerian capital, Algiers. Finally, in Tunisia, over 3,000 athletes from 17 countries are vying for honors at the Stride of Megara Half Marathon Championships in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, the 21st day of March.
I wish to commend President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan for the cancellation of the recent immigration interview that resulted to so many deaths. And I'm quite optimistic that the rescheduled interview shall be thoroughly sanitized. I am Prince John Ushir in Obanuku, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. The United Nations top human rights official says sectarian violence in the Central African Republic remains at a terrifying level and has prompted atrocities that include cannibalism. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, spoke at a news conference Thursday in Bangui as she wrapped up a three-day visit to that country. Pillay said the Central African Republic has become a country where people are not just killed, but are tortured, mutilated, burned, and dismembered. She said UN investigators know of at least four instances in which the killers ate the flesh of their victims. Well, that's it for this Friday, March 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strarak, as well as post editor Mark Oldman, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely weekend to Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.